or his general's insignia, or the stripes of a colonel. Some who saw him that day affirmed that he wore colonel's insignia, in the forlorn hope, perhaps, that the communists did not know they were capturing a French general. Soon de Castries' whole staff of 23 officers and men was assembled around him. What was said on either side remained somewhat fuzzy, as memories play tricks. Hearsay information picked up in the prison camps becomes confused with what one heard firsthand, and the desire to sublimate a harrowing experience becomes evident in every survivor. De Castries is said to have exclaimed either, "Don't shoot me," or "Don't shoot." But we also have a remarkable non-Asian source on the other side, the Russian film reporter Roman Lazarevich Karman. Karman had been sent to Dien Bien Phu by his government to help the North Vietnamese make a cinematographic record of the battle, but had been delayed en route by French bombings of the supply lines. However, he had arrived on the battlefield just a few days after the fight was over and had spoken to the young Viet Minh company commander. According to Karman, and under the circumstances, this seems a likely question, the Viet Minh captain looked at the assembled Frenchmen and asked, "Which one of you is General de Castries?" De Castries identified himself, and apparently, as he had planned earlier, asked the enemy officer whether he could tell his own troops to cease fighting. Ta Quang Loat answered with the assurance of the victor, to which he was clearly entitled. "That's superfluous. They've already given up without your order. We've won." In silence, the staff began to file out of the command bunker. In the disintegrating sandbags atop its curved steel roof, three Viet Minh soldiers, including platoon leader Chu Bat Thay, were planting the gold-starred red flag. That a red flag flew over the command bunker at Dien Bien Phu at about 1740 of May 7, 1954, is absolutely certain. Thousands of men saw it, and many of them mentioned it to me. None of them saw a white flag on top of the bunker, and not once did even communist propaganda invent one. A few days later, the planting of the red flag was reenacted by the Viet Minh for the Soviet cameraman Karman. They could just as well have reenacted a white flag fluttering over the bunker, being eventually replaced by the victorious red flag. I personally saw the film in Hanoi in its uncut version. Nowhere was a white flag in sight. Dien Bien Phu had fallen to the enemy, but it had not capitulated. In the failing daylight, the valley of Dien Bien Phu represented an incredible mixture of complete human misery as friend and foe alike made their way through the deep mud, and of pristine luxury as in some places mounds of rotting dead, the agonizing wounded, and foul-smelling trenches were covered with the immaculate whiteness of the last mist-dropped parachutes. A total of 82,926 parachutes had been dropped into the valley, including 3,763 huge cargo parachutes. Dien Bien Phu was the last battlefield in history in which not only the dead combatants, but even the ground itself, wore a white silk shroud. The western flank of the fortress was the last to be occupied by the Viet Minh, since its positions were still covered by extensive minefields and barbed wire entanglements. Some of the strong points on Claudine were occupied as late as 1820. One of the last to be occupied was Strong Point Lili, still held by a handful of Moroccans under Major Jean Nicolas. As Nicolas looked out over the battlefield from a slit trench near his command post, a small white flag, probably a handkerchief, appeared on top of a rifle hardly 50 feet away from him, followed by the flat-helmeted head of a Viet Minh soldier. "You're not going to shoot any more?" said the Viet Minh in French. "No, I'm not going to shoot any more," said Nicolas. "C'est fini?" said the Viet Minh. "Oui, c'est fini," said the French major. And all around them, as on some gruesome judgment day, mud-covered soldiers, French and enemy alike, began to crawl out of their trenches and stand erect as firing ceased everywhere. The silence was deafening. 11. Finale. Isabelle's Night. At 1755 of May 7, 1954, General Cogny contacted Colonel Lalande on Isabelle and asked him what his plans were for the night, without making any reference to the fate that had already befallen the main position at Dien Bien Phu itself. But smothered by heavy artillery fire as they were, and unable to raise any of their usual radio contacts in the main position, the men on Isabelle knew very well what fate had befallen the garrison. While it may look inspirational in history books, there is no evidence that General de Castries at Dien Bien Phu had requested that the last remaining artillery piece at Isabel fire directly on his bunker during the last phase of the Viet Minh attack on the central position. It is, however, likely that the lone howitzer continued to fire its normal supporting mission on Claudine, but was told to cease firing at 1700. At about 1900, Isabel destroyed its last heavy equipment, including Lieutenant Henri Préau's tank Ratisbonne. Colonel Lalanne had some misgivings about the southern itinerary. While he, for obvious reasons, had not participated in the discussions that had led to the planning of Operation Bloodletting, he was well aware of the fact that the Viet Minh would expect him to break out southward. But the fighting around Isabel for the last few days seemed to show that the more daring northward operation would perhaps meet with greater success. What Lalande had in mind was to dash northward in the direction of Dien Bien Phu up to the village of Bon Loi, that is, just below the siege ring around the main position. Particularly with the main French position already in enemy hands, chances were that the trench system would be poorly manned and certainly not prepared for a French attack from Isabel. At Bon Loi, then, Lalande planned on pivoting straight west across the Namyum and into the nearby forest north of Ban Co Mai. The plan was eminently sound and might even have had a chance of success, but General Coni's headquarters in Hanoi remained mute when questioned by Lalande via the radio relay of the command plane circling overhead. In the face of that silence, there is no evidence from the existing radio message logs that an answer to that query was ever given. Lalande then decided to attempt the originally planned breakout in a southerly direction. At 21:40, Lieutenant Colonel Dussault reported from Command Aircraft No. 545, Yankee Alpha, a series of continuous explosions on Isabel, which he identified as its depots being blown up. At 2200, the Air Force radio operator inside the aircraft, in charge of monitoring the channel of the SCR-300 radios of the infantry units inside Isabel, suddenly overheard a conversation in Vietnamese. Since he was not sure whether they were radio operators from Vietnamese units inside Isabel, there were none, or of Viet Minh units on the siege ring using captured American radio sets, he addressed the radio operators in French. The conversation broke immediately, and a guttural voice said, "What do you want, monsieur?" The Air Force operator did not reply. The other two radio operators were from the enemy side, and they were openly operating on Isabel's infantry channel. And now Isabel's breakout began. Scouting in the lead were the tough little tribesmen of Mobile Auxiliary Companies 431 and 432 of Lieutenant Weim, followed by the 12th and 11th companies of the 33 Foreign Legion under Major Grand Desnon. Lieutenant Preaud's tank crews, with the exception of two wounded men who had to be left behind in the infirmary, marched as a platoon with 11th Company. Behind them came Isabel's headquarters unit, the remaining tie of Major Thimonnier's 3rd BT, and Captain Johnsonel's 2nd Battalion 1st Algerian Rifles. Here again, mythology must give way to history. There was no bayonet charge, as has been variously asserted, but there was no capitulation on Isabel either. On the contrary, Isabel's garrison made the only organized attempt at breaking out from the doomed valley, and it almost succeeded. The sortie was undertaken in three waves. The first, made up of 12th Company and Weim's tribesmen, quietly slipped southward along the winding riverbed of the Nam Yum and covered 9 kilometers before it ran into a communist blocking position at Pom Lot at around 0200 of May 8th. Had there been more strength in that spearhead force, chances might have been good for more men to break out. In the ensuing firefight, the small force was destroyed and Weim was captured, but 10 of his tribesmen and Sergeant Beguin and 2 of the legionnaires from 12th Company managed to slip through. The rest of the column never had a chance. The platoon formed by the tank crews, along with 11th Company, fell into a double ambush just 1 kilometer south of Isabel. The Algerian riflemen who followed behind were barely out of the barbed wire entanglements when they were attacked. And since they, in turn, were followed by a horde of walking wounded and other unarmed service personnel who had refused to be left behind, all discipline suddenly collapsed as part of the men attempted to go forward, while others, including now Colonel Lalanne and his staff, attempted to regain the bunker line for a last stand. But the very chaos of that last battle, in total darkness except for the occasional glare of flare shells, gave those units who had retained some sort of cohesion a small chance. The tank crews veered sharply to the west into the nearby dark hills with a speed that surprised the enemy. Lieutenant Préaux and two of his men were captured, but the rest of the platoon managed to break away as a unit. Although they were to suffer casualties later, 2nd Platoon of Composite Squadron, 1st Regiment of Armored Chasseurs, was the only unit to leave the valley as an organization, rather than as a mob of individuals. From where Algerian Lieutenant Belabiche was trying to keep the 80 men of his 8th Company together, the situation looked completely hopeless. He could not even order his men to shoot, for fear that the shadows in front of him were friendly rather than enemy. The Viet Minh seemed to have a similar problem, what with its troops now swarming all around the French, and it became suddenly clear to Belabiche that the Viet Minh were no longer shooting at the men, but rather were aiming over their heads. It would not be surprising that, as Jules Roy indicates, a small group of Viet Minh officers under a flag of truce found it extremely difficult to make their way through that compact mass of humanity in order to meet Lalande and tell him to cease fighting, as further resistance was useless. At 0150, the command aircraft picked up the very last message a Frenchman would send from Dien Bien Phu. Sortie failed. Stop. Can no longer communicate with you. Stop and end. It was the end indeed. The end of the Indochina War. The end of France as a colonial power. Later that night, a privateer four-engine bomber of French Navy Squadron No. 28F was shot down while bombing Viet Minh communication lines along Road 41. Its pilot, Ensign Monguilon, and its crew of 8 warrant officers and petty officers were the last Frenchmen killed in combat in the Battle of Dien Bien Phu. Outside, May 7, 1954. There is a time zone difference of 7 hours between Paris and Dien Bien Phu. It was 10:30 Paris time on May 7th when the red flag was hoisted atop de Castries' command bunker at Dien Bien Phu. The news probably reached the French government around noon. At 16:30, the French government informed the National Assembly, France's major legislative body, that the Prime Minister would present it with an important communication. At 16:45, the 65-year-old Joseph Laniel, the bull-necked Norman who had become Prime Minister in June 1953, mounted the tribune, escorted by several of his cabinet ministers. The Prime Minister was dressed entirely in black. The news of the disaster already had reached Paris, and the hemicycle was filled with legislators. Every seat in the visitors' gallery and in the press section was taken. The Prime Minister said in a voice which he vainly attempted to control, and which was at first so low as to be barely audible even with the help of the public address system, "The government has been informed that the central position of Dien Bien Phu has fallen after 20 hours of uninterrupted violent combat." As he said those words, his voice broke. There was an audible gasp in the audience, and in a clatter of seats, the legislators, the visitors, and the press rose to their feet, with the exception of the 95 communists and M. Charles de Chambrun, a legislator from the Progressive Party allied with the communists. In the dead silence which followed, punctuated only by the loud sobs of a woman legislator, Laniel continued, "Strongpoint Isabelle is still holding. The enemy has wanted to obtain the fall of Dien Bien Phu prior to the opening of the conference on Indochina. He believes that he could strike a decisive blow against the morale of France. He has responded to our goodwill, to France's will for peace, by sacrificing thousands of his soldiers to crush under their number the heroes who, for 55 days, have excited the admiration of the world. France must remind her allies that for 7 years now the army of the French Union has unceasingly protected a particularly crucial region of Asia and has alone defended the interests of all. All of France shares the anguish of the families of the fighters of Dien Bien Phu. Their heroism has reached such heights that universal conscience should dictate to the enemy, in favor of the wounded and of those whose courage entitles them to the honors of war, such decisions as will contribute more than anything to establish a climate favorable to peace." The news of the disaster covered France like a thick blanket. Maurice Cardinal Feltin, the Archbishop of Paris, ordered a solemn mass to be said for the dead and prisoners of Dien Bien Phu. The Paris Opera, which was to be the host for the first time since the end of World War II to the Moscow Opera Ballet, cancelled the whole series of Russian performances. French television, In France, both radio and television are government-controlled, cancelled its programs for the evening, and the three radio networks cancelled all entertainment shows and replaced them with programs of French classical music, and notably Hector Berlioz's Requiem. It was the only Requiem which the thousands of dead of Dien Bien Phu were ever going to get. In Nice, on the French Riviera, the chief of state of the non-communist Vietnamese regime, Bao Dai, whose name, in translation, means keeper of greatness, but who preferred the life of the French Riviera to the chores of facing a war in Vietnam, issued a statement of his own, in which he thanked the French for the sacrifices they had made. Now that France has recognized the independence of Vietnam, no one can have any doubts as to the unselfish nobleness of her defense of the Vietnamese people and of the free world. The French can be assured that Vietnam shall not forget the sacrifices of France. In Saigon, there was a double rush. On one hand, a call-up of 120,000 young Vietnamese had brought in only 7,000 draftees, of whom 5,000 were declared unfit for service. And the news of the defeat brought an avalanche of Vietnamese and French bank transfers to Hong Kong, where the Vietnamese piastre suddenly rose from a black market rate of about 60 to the U.S. dollar to 85. The news of the fall of Dien Bien Phu hit the United States too late for the morning newspapers of May 7th, but that is precisely what makes them doubly interesting. For Dien Bien Phu had in fact disappeared as front-page news a great deal earlier. While the French were dying on the Alliance, America was glued to its television sets, watching the now-deceased junior senator from Wisconsin grilling the Secretary of the Army and an Army general as to why an obscure Army dentist with alleged left-wing leanings had been routinely promoted from captain to major. At the very moment when the Viet Minh Mine Gallery blew up Alliance II, Dien Bien Phu made page 6 of America's most respected newspaper. On the day that Dien Bien Phu fell, Senator McCarthy challenged the right of the executive to keep secret data from Congress, and Dien Bien Phu rated page 3. However, a senator from Texas, Lyndon B. Johnson, made a speech before the annual Jefferson-Jackson Day Democratic dinner in Washington, in the course of which he clearly showed the beginnings of a deep interest in Vietnam, which was to grow after he became president. What is American policy on Indochina? All of us have listened to the dismal series of reversals and confusions and alarms and excursions which have emerged from Washington over the past few weeks. It is apparent only that American foreign policy has never in all its history suffered such a stunning reversal. We have been caught bluffing by our enemies. Our friends and allies are frightened and wondering, as we do, where we are headed. We stand in clear danger of being left naked and alone in a hostile world. This picture of our country needlessly weakened in the world today is so painful that we should turn our eyes from abroad and look homeward. Coming after his crucial intervention of April 3rd, the May 6th speech of the future president committed him to a certain position on the Vietnam problem. Once president, Lyndon B. Johnson, contrary to the opinions of those who had denied him a deep knowledge of foreign affairs, acted in accordance with the lessons he had learned from Dien Bien Phu. There would be no American Dien Bien Phu as long as he could help it. At 21:30 Eastern Daylight Time, Secretary of State Dulles gave an account of recent events to the American people, in which he paid brief homage to De Castries and his men. The French soldiers showed that they have not lost either the will or the skill to fight even under the most adverse conditions. It shows that Vietnam produces soldiers who have the qualities to enable them to defend their country. In his speech, Secretary Dulles was also careful to lay the blame for American failure to act, both on British Prime Minister Winston Churchill's failure to agree to a united action in Vietnam prior to the Geneva Conference, and upon the U.S. Congress as well. Here again, what Dulles had to say was of crucial importance in the shaping of the American commitment to Vietnam a decade later. In making commitments which might involve the use of armed force, the Congress is a full partner. Only the Congress can declare war. President Eisenhower has repeatedly emphasized that he would not take military action in Indochina without the support of Congress. Furthermore, he has made clear that he would not seek that unless, in his opinion, there would be an adequate collective effort based on genuine mutuality of purpose in defending vital interests. In other words, the French defeat at Dien Bien Phu would be written off, and the negotiations at Geneva would be allowed to take their preordained course. It was left to Life magazine to find at least something of a bright aspect to the end of the fortress. The single ray of hope over the graves of Dien Bien Phu, said the periodical in its issue of May 7, 1954, is the fact that one obstacle to united action, the heroic stubbornness of France, has been removed. Saturday, May 8, 1954. May 8 was the 9th anniversary of VE Day, the victory of the Allies over Nazi Germany, and it now also became the anniversary of a new French defeat. The evening before, at the main position of Dien Bien Phu, the Viet Minh had rounded up and herded together their French captives in long columns. They had looked with empty eyes at General de Castries and some of his senior staff officers being driven past them in jeeps. It was the 308th Iron Division, which had taken control of the battlefield, and its commanding general, stocky, gray-haired Vuong Thua Vu, had established his command post in de Castries' command bunker. At 20:00 of May 7th, Dr. Groin received a visit from Dr. Tai, the chief surgeon of the 308th, accompanied by four younger doctors from the division. Tai was tall for a Vietnamese, and very thin and pale. He had walked along with his division for more than 600 miles from the Chinese border, and he, like Groin, had spent the last 3 months day and night at the operating table. A graduate of the French University of Bordeaux and the medical school of Montpellier, he spoke excellent French. In silence, he had walked through the nightmare of the overcrowded hospital bunkers, enveloped in the stench of the dead and the dying, and had sat down on a small stool in Groin's niche-like room, while Groin himself sat down on his own bunk bed. The communist medical officer looked at his French counterpart and said, "We have seen, as we passed through, your bunkers crammed with wounded. We've recognized that odor. We understand what you must have gone through, but there is nothing we could do about it. That's all I can tell you." Groin looked up in surprise. The enemy turned out to be human, too. Within a short time, the doctors agreed that first of all the wounded would have to be taken out from the underground dugouts and transferred to open-air hospitals and dressing stations. With the superabundance of nylon parachutes lying about all over the camp, the erection of temporary tents would present no difficulty whatever. The French doctors and medical personnel would be able to stay at their jobs under the supervision of Viet Minh medical personnel. The Viet Minh medics would, on the other hand, be able to borrow surgical equipment and, above all, antibiotics, which were almost non-existent on the enemy side. Groin had foreseen the latter request and had carefully hidden part of his small store of precious antibiotics in camouflaged sewer drains inside the bunkers. In the meantime, however, he was greatly relieved as to the fate of his wounded and grateful for the understanding shown by his captors. Matters were to change 2 days later, when the political commissars took charge of everything. On Isabelle, the early hours of dawn were spent in collecting the French prisoners. The fact that Isabelle's last stand had taken place in the dark of night immediately made matters more difficult all around. Also, the 304th People's Army Division, which was in charge of Isabelle and which was largely recruited from the Red River Delta and had some long-standing scores to settle with the French, seemed to have decided to treat the enemy more brusquely. At 0600, as the soldiers of the 2-1 Algerian Rifles sat under tight Viet Minh guard along the road leading northward out of Isabelle, they were bypassed by Colonel Lalande and his staff, walking northward under heavy guard with their hands tied tightly behind their backs. But now began for the enemy the fantastically complicated job of sorting close to 10,000 enemy troops of various nationalities. From the outset, the enemy decided to separate the prisoners by national backgrounds and to split them into 50-man groups. Frenchmen would walk with Frenchmen, and Algerians, Moroccans, and Vietnamese would also form specific units. The foreign legionnaires, in turn, were subdivided according to their national origins into German, Italian, Spanish, and East European groups. Non-commissioned officers would be separated from the lower ranks, and the officers from all other groups. That way, the bulk of the prisoners would become a totally leaderless mob in the hands of their captors. That process of sorting out took several days. It is during that period that most of the successful escapes took place. The officers were immediately segregated and faced with prolonged interrogations about every detail of the defense of Dien Bien Phu. Their every word was recorded, not by one, but by several French-speaking stenographers, and sometimes tape-recorded. Often, the same officer was questioned several times about the same subject by the French-speaking interrogators. Particular attention was paid to officers of non-French descent, such as the Algerians. When Lieutenant Bellabiche was brought in for interrogation, he noticed with shock that the interrogating officer was in possession of a perfectly accurate large-scale map of Isabelle, showing the exact positioning of every unit inside the French strongpoint. The Viet Minh was interested not only in what the French actually did do, but also in the various contingencies that could have arisen, possible counterattacks, alternate fields of fire, etc. The enemy interrogator also had Bellabiche's personal file, probably found among the papers which his battalion headquarters had failed to burn, and saw his citation for the Legion of Honor. He looked up at Bellabiche and said, "You are an Algerian. Are you going to stay with us to struggle for the liberation of your country?" When Lieutenant Bellabiche refused, the interrogator's whole attitude changed. To him, Bellabiche had become just another lackey of the imperialists. 8 years later, Bellabiche was a captain in the Algerian National Liberation Army, training young Algerian officers at what had been the French officers' candidate school at Cherchel, west of Algiers. In Hanoi, the French army had, as every year, planned a VE Day parade, and on May 7th, Vietnamese workers had to put up French and Vietnamese national flags along the main avenue leading to the war memorial, and had mounted a reviewing stand for the Vietnamese and French VIPs, including General Cogny, who would attend the ceremony. It was probably the grimmest victory parade ever held, made up, as it was, of the Hanoi-based remnants of the units that had been destroyed the day before at Dien Bien Phu, headquarters and depot units of the 3rd Foreign Legion Regiment, the 1st Company of the 1st BPC, and a few isolated paratroopers who had missed the last jump into Dien Bien Phu for the good reason that they had been wounded elsewhere and had just left the hospital. Several of the paratroop officers limped noticeably as they filed by the reviewing stand. They wore their full battle gear, and their alignment was impeccable, but to many observers they looked as dejected as their comrades in arm must have looked, as at that very moment, across 300 kilometers of mountains, they were forming into groups for the march to the communist prison camps. Even the French population of Hanoi had deserted its army. Of the 500,000 Vietnamese and perhaps 10,000 French citizens in Hanoi, only 300 or 400 had shown up to watch the parade. Now began the agonizing wait for news by the families of the men who were missing at Dien Bien Phu. Madame de Castries, who had spoken briefly to her husband over the official radio telephone as late as 1600 on May 7th, and who until now had been freely available to journalists, had locked herself in her hotel room. On the morning of May 8th, she drove to Lanessan Military Hospital to visit with the wounded from Dien Bien Phu, who had been flown out with the last ambulance aircraft in March. A young blonde woman, very thin but obviously pregnant, was also seen piloting her bicycle into the headquarters of General Cogny in the Hanoi Citadel. The bicycle was equipped with a small rear seat holding a baby. The woman was Madame Millien, the wife of de Castries' radio operator. Other families were anxiously clinging to the radio sets, where the illegal transmitter of the enemy forces had begun to give the names of the captured survivors. The French army, however, soon began to jam the transmission. The effect of the interminable recital of names was judged to be too demoralizing on everybody. But that morning also, Radio Hirondelle, Swallow, had transmitted a brief message from General Navarre to his forces, labeled Order of the Day No. 9. The message underlined that the garrison, fighting against a 5-to-1 superiority, had fixed 30 enemy battalions for 5 months, thus saving Upper Laos from invasion and preserving the Tonkinese Delta. Navarre blamed the fall of Dien Bien Phu on Chinese communist aid, which suddenly allowed the enemy to inaugurate a type of modern warfare that was entirely new to the Indochinese theater of operations. The defenders of Dien Bien Phu, Navarre said, had added to the long history of the French armed forces one of its most glorious pages, and had given the French forces in Indochina and the Vietnamese army a new pride and a new reason for fighting, because the struggle of the free peoples against slavery does not end today. The fight continues. On the communist side, President Ho Chi Minh waited until May 13th to issue a victory proclamation, followed by one of General Vo Nguyen Giap. Ho's was a typical mixture of the determination and modesty in tone for which he is known. "Let me first of all express to you my affectionate solicitude to the wounded and to all of you. The government and I have decided to recompense you. But in what way? As far as the present circumstances permit, we shall do so because we attach great importance to it. We have the intention of distributing to each of you the insignia of Combatant of Dien Bien Phu. Do you agree with this? Once more, let me advise you to be modest in your victory. Do not underestimate the enemy, and remain ready to accomplish everything the party and the government might ask of you. I embrace you affectionately, your uncle, Ho Chi Minh." I saw the round red-starred brass button with the inscription Qianxi Dien Bien, Combatant of Dien Bien Phu, on many a shirt in Hanoi almost a decade later. It is still being worn proudly. Giap's proclamation widely differed in tone from Ho's. It was, like the man himself, doctrinaire and proud. "The Dien Bien Phu victory is the most prestigious which our army has ever achieved. In liberating the strategic northwestern region of our country, we have further expanded our zone of resistance and contributed to the success of the land reform. We have brought failure to the Navarre plan and struck a rude blow against the intrigues of the French colonialist warmongers and the American interventionists who wanted to expand the Indochina War. If our troops have been victorious at Dien Bien Phu, this is due to the enlightened guidance of President Ho Chi Minh, of the Central Committee of the Party, and of the government. It is also due to the heroism, the courage, the endurance of all the cadres and of all the combatants at the front, their spirit of sacrifice and their will to win. It is due even more to the ardor and the enthusiasm of the people's porters of the population in the northwest and of the rear areas. In the name of the army, I warmly thank all the porters and the whole population. The General, Commander-in-Chief, Vo Nguyen Giap." The last funeral oration to be said officially over Dien Bien Phu was delivered on May 8th at 1615 in the League of Nations Palace overlooking an expanse of magnificently manicured lawns extending down to the quiet shores of Lake Geneva. There, after having ineffectually debated about the reunification of Korea for over 2 weeks while Dien Bien Phu was agonizing, the West was now ready to meet the Communist bloc on the matter of peace in Indochina, and under the effect of the shattering defeat of the day before, it fell to the French Foreign Minister, Georges Bidault, to make the opening statement. The small, intense man, with the unruly parted hair falling on his forehead, looked awful after weeks of harrowing negotiations and travels. Like his Prime Minister when he addressed the French Parliament the day before, Bidault was almost homeless at first, and while his premier at least had the consolation of addressing a largely friendly audience at home, the French foreign minister now had to acknowledge France's defeat not only under the glaring camera lights of the world's press, but also under the close scrutiny of the victorious communist leaders, Chou Enlai of Red China, Vyacheslav Molotov of the Soviet Union, and Pham Van Dong, the foreign minister and later prime minister of the communist Vietnamese regime. And there simply was no way out. There was no possibility of not speaking of Dien Bien Phu at that particular moment in history. The defeat, no matter what would happen later, was too important to be ignored. And Bidault, like France herself, stood there alone. The delegations of the three little Indochinese states of Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam were of little help at that juncture. The British Foreign Secretary, Anthony Eden, was the co-chairman with Russia of the conference, and, in view of Britain's role in the Indochina conflict during the recent weeks, barely on speaking terms with his French colleague. As for the United States delegation, the Secretary of State, in one of his repeated confusions between the appearance and the reality of American prestige, had preferred to return to the United States and leave the American delegation in the capable but less prestigious hands of his Undersecretary, General Walter Bedell Smith. Bidault was reported to have said to an associate that he had come to Geneva with a two of clubs and a three of diamonds as his only diplomatic cards. As he looked around him before he began to speak, at his fellow Western diplomats and their embarrassedly downcast eyes, and at the communist diplomats staring at him unblinkingly, he was the very picture of France's loneliness in her defeat. Addressing the British Foreign Secretary, who was in the chair for this inaugural session, Vidal said, "Mr. Chairman, at the outset of this conference, I should like to describe its dramatic prelude in the most cruel battle in a conflict which has been going on for 7 years. It was not our side which wished, while peace was being discussed, an intensification of combat going as far as a refusal to allow evacuation of the wounded contrary to the laws of war and to the principles of the civilized world. The issue of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu was announced yesterday by the Commander-in-Chief in these words: the garrison of Dien Bien Phu has fulfilled the mission assigned to it by the command. The French delegation cannot conceal here its deep emotion and its pride in the face of the heroism of the combatants of France, of Vietnam, and of all of the French Union who had resisted beyond human endurance." Vidal, who had been the civilian leader of all the French resistance forces inside Nazi-occupied France, choked as he spoke those words, and then, mercifully, the text switched to the normal diplomatic details of the French position, and Vidal regained his composure. Buried in the last third of the text was a short four-line paragraph, which, in the rapid-fire French delivery of the foreign minister, seemed no more important than the previous or the following, but which indeed contained all that there was to be said. "We propose that the conference should, first of all, declare that it adopt the principle of a general cessation of hostilities in Indochina based upon the necessary guarantees of security, the terms of the principles thus enunciated being inseparable in our mind and in our resolution." In effect, one day after the loss of Dien Bien Phu, France had sued for peace in Indochina. In Paris also, this had been VE Day, and French officialdom was tradition-bound to make the pilgrimage to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier at the Arch of Triumph at the top of the Champs-Élysées. But instead of being joyful, a large crowd behind the reinforced police cordon looked sullen. Even the popular French figurehead president, René Coty, got only a scattering of perfunctory applause. Premier Joseph Laniel did not fare as well as he rode past, followed closely by Defense Minister René Clément. Some people cried out, "Send them to Dien Bien Phu," while others cried out the familiar French threat to unpopular politicians, "Au poteau," to the firing squad. After the official ceremony was over, a simple black Citroën car drove up, and out of it stepped an extremely tall and heavy 65-year-old man in the light tan uniform of a French brigadier general. Although he was retired both from the army and from politics, a French military band awaited him at the Arch of Triumph, and a huge crowd had remained behind the police barriers for his appearance. The tall general walked in silence to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, saluted the French flag, bowed his head in meditation, and then walked back to his car. As he looked at the cheering crowd with his myopic eyes and gave it his characteristic bent-elbow wave, cheers of "Vive de Gaulle" and "De Gaulle au pouvoir," "De Gaulle to power," could be heard everywhere. The tall brigadier general heard, and he would not forget. The wounded. On the battlefield itself, the major problem remained the disposition of the hundreds of seriously wounded who now were captives of the enemy. It was obvious that the Viet Minh did not have the medical or transport facilities to care adequately for them on the spot, or to transport them to his own rear areas. Unless a battlefield truce could be obtained almost immediately, many of the seriously wounded prisoners would die. Both sides knew this, and the enemy, aware of the public pressure on the French to retrieve the wounded prisoners in some way or another, now sought to extract the maximum in concessions from the French. French reconnaissance aircraft, maintaining a constant vigil over the battlefield, had noticed the raising of the parachute tents in the valley, followed by the laying out of an immense red cross on a field of white parachutes, a sign that the enemy was not going to use the valley for military operations. This encouraged the French to continue to drop 4 airplane loads a day of food, drugs, and ice into the valley, in the hopes that at least a small part of the supplies would be used for the wounded prisoners. A small part was used, and on the afternoon of May 11th, General Navarre had a personal message to General Giap parachuted into the valley, followed up by a repetition of the same message over the French military transmitter in Hanoi, addressed to The commander-in-chief, General Vo Nguyen Giap, Navarre asked the enemy commander to let him know how arrangements could be made to evacuate the French wounded from Dien Bien Phu. At 18:30 of May 11th came the answer from the Viet Minh. Giap authorized French representatives to come to Dien Bien Phu directly in order to negotiate the release and transfer of the wounded prisoners. A helicopter with Red Cross insignia would be authorized to land on the northern part of the Dien Bien Phu airstrip, below where Huguette 6 used to be. Navarre immediately appointed as head of the French mission a man who, beyond a doubt, was the most qualified in all of Indochina to lead such a negotiation. He was Dr. Pierre Huard. Huard was the dean of the Hanoi University Medical School, president of the French Red Cross in Indochina, and a reserve colonel in the French Army Medical Corps. He had, by then, been living in Vietnam for 20 years, was married to a Vietnamese woman, spoke Vietnamese almost perfectly, and in the 1930s had protected many a Vietnamese nationalist or communist firebrand against the rigors of the French colonial administration. As head of the Red Cross throughout the Indochina War, he had impartially maintained contact with the Viet Minh Red Cross organization and had, even in the midst of the Indochina War, traveled across the lines into Viet Minh territory to arrange for the exchange of sick or wounded prisoners of both sides. He also had seen to it, as far as was possible, that the French and Vietnamese military treated Viet Minh prisoners in their hands in accordance with international rules of war. A tall and thin figure with kind eyes, without any insignia on his tropical uniform, and always wearing the kind of pith helmet that had gone out of fashion 3 decades earlier, Huard looked like a sort of Asian Dr. Schweitzer, accompanied by a Major James from the French Army and a Major Roger from the French Air Force. Huard flew on May 12th to the Laotian capital of Luang Prabang, where a helicopter awaited him. On Thursday, May 13th, at 1100, he and his small team landed at Dien Bien Phu. The negotiations covered several extremely difficult points. First of all, it was necessary to define who was a severely wounded soldier and who was not, and who was to make the selection of those prisoners. Then, a decision had to be made as to the type of airlift that would be instituted to remove the wounded. Fixed-wing aircraft that could pick up 18-liter cases at once, but whose use was limited until the airfield could be reconstructed, or helicopters, which, considering the type then available in Indochina and the long distances involved, could carry only a few wounded at a time, but could begin their job almost immediately. The most serious problem in the negotiations was the countercessions demanded by the enemy. These included not only the non-intervention of the French Air Force within a radius of 10 kilometers of the valley of Dien Bien Phu, but also the immunity from bombardment of large tracts of Road 41. The latter point was the most important to the Viet Minh, and the most dangerous to the French. For if there remained a shred of military rationality to the whole battle of Dien Bien Phu, it was that the prolonged defense of the valley had tied down a considerable part of the enemy's main battle force far away from the Red River Delta, and that the Viet Minh would find it extremely difficult to turn the whole massive siege force around and bring it back into attack position around the delta before General Cogny had received the additional reinforcements needed to contain such an attack. All depended upon whether the major transportation arteries of Road 41, and to a lesser extent Road 7 from Laos, could at least be partially interdicted, or their use made as expensive as possible to the enemy. With understandable logic, General Giap now decided to use the approximately 10,000 prisoners in his hands in the same way the Japanese used Allied prisoners on their supply ships during World War II. In the latter case, Allied prisoners would be placed in clearly visible positions on the main decks of Japanese transports carrying raw materials back to Japan, with the consequence that Allied aircraft or submarines faced the quandary of either letting a Japanese ship return to Japan with a precious cargo of raw materials, or destroying the ship, and with it hundreds of their own comrades. In the case of Dien Bien Phu, the Viet Minh decided to intersperse its own infantry and artillery columns with convoys of French prisoners. That way, French bombers seeking to interdict the strategic roads would be faced with the problem of having to kill their own comrades as they attacked. The Viet Minh explained that their own wounded, and there were of course thousands of them, would also travel over those roads, so that there was a direct quid pro quo between opening the Dien Bien Phu airfield to French planes and keeping the roads open to communist trucks. The French had no choice but to accede. To do otherwise would have meant sacrificing the lives of perhaps 1,500 seriously wounded men for the sake of a nebulous short-term military advantage. Aroused public opinion at home and abroad probably would not have stood for it. The problem of the selection of the wounded to be evacuated was perhaps less crucial, but in human terms just as difficult. As Dr. Groin knew, nearly all the prisoners were physically in no condition to march 600 kilometers through the jungle. In many cases, men who had had relatively light wounds, but who had lost a great deal of blood, were in worse condition to undertake the trek than others who had suffered perhaps a more serious wound, such as the amputation of an arm, but who had recovered from it. Also, there was the problem of the wounded from the Vietnamese National Army, who had fallen into Viet Minh hands. The communists considered their own nationals who had fought on the French side as traitors, and at first refused to include them among the wounded to be selected for evacuation. Again, the French were confronted by a terrible quandary. If the whole evacuation process were to be jeopardized for the sake of a small percentage of Vietnamese wounded, French public opinion at home would be incensed. Yet, if the Vietnamese wounded, who had fought valiantly side by side with the French, were to be abandoned to the untender mercies of the Viet Minh, the ensuing demoralization among the already badly demoralized Vietnamese army troops outside of Dien Bien Phu would lead to a massive military crisis in Indochina itself. The negotiations were stopped, and Colonel Luard returned to Hanoi for consultations with the French high command. What followed in the next few days was a neat example of sound psychological warfare. Even though the negotiations had not yet brought about a positive result, the Viet Minh High Command authorized the removal via helicopter of a limited number of wounded from Dien Bien Phu. Their arrival in Laos and Hanoi, with ensuing tales of horror and misery from the valley, immediately produced an increased amount of pressure on the French to be less adamant. Huard and his mission returned to Dien Bien Phu on May 16th, and signed the following day an agreement providing for the evacuation of 858 wounded, to be selected according to medical criteria alone, regardless of nationality. But the French had to pay a heavy price for that minor concession. There would be no neutral inspection of the valley or of the POW convoys leaving it, and the French Air Force would refrain from bombing the road until the evacuation of the wounded was completed. The French military knew that they had yielded a significant military advantage, but under the circumstances, there seemed to be no other way out. With the preliminary accord in his pocket, the enemy now began the clearing and reconstruction of the Dien Bien Phu airstrip at a snail's pace, but allowed French helicopters and single-engine planes to come in to pick up a few wounded at a time. By May 25th, the airfield still was not cleared for C-47s, and the Viet Minh, who had until now refused the help of French demining experts to clear the field, now requested that such experts be flown in. In the meantime, the pressures had also mounted inside the camp, as Viet Minh political commissars began to take their own doctors in hand. The wounded were reclassified, according to what was called their democratic urgency rather than their medical urgency, with the non-Europeans of the lowest rank being given preferred medical treatment over the European soldiers, and the latter being treated earlier or better than their non-commissioned officers and officers. When several parachute defects resulted in the crashing into the camp of some loads of medical cargo, the Viet Minh forbade such airdrops, but allowed the evacuation helicopters and small aircraft to bring in whatever supplies they could carry with their small payloads. And above all, since the French medical staff in the camp had no idea as to the results of the negotiations that were underway, it was put under heavy pressure to sign appeals for clemency for the sake of obtaining the release of their wounded. Two female political commissars were especially assigned to Mademoiselle de Galard, the French nurse, to make her sign a series of special appeals because of their particular emotional impact coming from the single Frenchwoman at Dien Bien Phu. Dr. Groin later described in detail how she resisted for 10 days, but then gave way on his orders. He also signed a separate appeal because of their fear that it would be the wounded who would have to pay the price of her fortitude. All these appeals had to be written and rewritten several times until they fit the propaganda requirements of the victors, and they were of course immediately used for propaganda purposes and appeared in the world press. Mademoiselle de Galard thus wrote a letter to Ho Chi Minh on the occasion of his 64th birthday on May 19th, in which she thanked him for his clemency toward the wounded prisoners, and in which she promised that upon her return to France she would attempt to create, among the young people who surround me, an atmosphere of greater understanding between our two peoples, so as to help, in my way, to re-establish peace. Once she had written that letter, she was informed by her two commissars that she would be released, but that she must write yet another letter to Ho Chi Minh and another to the women's organization of the Viet Minh. In her second letter, she held out for something that was dear to her heart, the release of her companions on the medical teams, and while again covering the same ground about struggling for peace upon her return to France, she also added that, while my joy to return home is great, it would be very imperfect if I were to leave alone, leaving behind me the other medical personnel, doctors, as well as attendants, with whom I have worked ceaselessly to care for our wounded. Thus, I ask you not to forget them, and I am sure that no one ever appeals in vain to your clemency. A few days later, Ho Chi Minh himself showed Mademoiselle de Galard's letter to the Russian film journalist Carmen, and added, General de Castri also speaks for peace now. Before the battle, he didn't speak for peace. Unfortunately, on May 22nd at 1500, three French Air Force planes bombed and strafed Road 41 2 kilometers south of Conoy, wounding and killing many French prisoners along with their captors. In reprisal, the Viet Minh removed the remaining French medical personnel, including Dr. Grouin, and sent them on the POW trek on Road 41. It was a neat psychological trick. They marched for days, like the other prisoners, but then were loaded on trucks, shipped back to Dien Bien Phu, and released with the last wounded in the first week of June 1954. Another airlift awaited the most complicated cases. The United States, as a last charitable gesture, offered to treat them at military hospitals in the United States, and soon Operation Wounded Warrior was underway, airlifting survivors from Saigon half around the world to Westover Field, Massachusetts. 10 years later, Warrant Officer Leideke of the Foreign Legion, stationed at one of the last French forts in the Sahara, at Inecker, recalled with pride how he had been taught English by American co-eds from Mount Holyoke College, an institution near Westover, once they had found out that the French and Legionnaires from Dien Bien Phu were, in Leideke's words, humans like all other humans. As for Mademoiselle de Galard, she was released as promised on May 24th. The young woman arrived in Hanoi at 20:30, still wearing her cut-down camouflage uniform of the French paratroops. She had made an effort to be as clean as she could, but as she stepped off the plane, her jungle boots were still covered with the brown mud of Dien Bien Phu. When she left for France a few days later, Geneviève de Galard Taroub had spent over 4 years in Indochina and had flown 149 medical evacuation missions, including 40 to Dien Bien Phu. Madame de Castri had left Hanoi on May 23rd for Paris, where she arrived on May 26th at 11:55. The French Secretaries of State for Indochina Affairs and for the National Defense, Marc Jacquet and Pierre de Chevigné, were awaiting her at Orly Field. She wore a beige coat and a white, close-fitting bonnet, and for once refused to speak to the press. A Citroën automobile of the French General Staff, driven by a gendarme, carried her off to the city. Also on May 24th, a seriously wounded master sergeant was lifted out of the valley of Dien Bien Phu to the Laotian capital of Luang Prabang. He was a Hungarian by the name of Beres, and had served with the 1st VEP on Ouguette. On May 19th, while the Viet Minh were celebrating Ho Chi Minh's birthday, Beres had dragged himself into the tent of a nearby Viet Minh command post, where he had previously noticed a Foreign Legion guidon that apparently had fallen intact into enemy hands. It was the fanion of the 4th Company, 1st Battalion, 13th Foreign Legion Half Brigade, which had been destroyed during the very first assault on Beatrice on March 13th. Sergeant Beres grabbed the green and red guidon with its gold stitching and quickly stuffed it under his shirt. Luckily, he was not too closely searched on his departure, and, no doubt for reasons of face, the Viet Minh never acknowledged that any prisoner, and particularly a severely wounded prisoner, could have eluded its surveillance sufficiently to steal the flag. Thus, the Foreign Legion became the only outfit at Dien Bien Phu to have saved one of its battle flags from destruction or capture. The prisoners. According to admittedly incomplete French Army statistics, The garrison of Dien Bien Phu counted on May 5 a total of 8,158 able-bodied or lightly wounded men. It had suffered since November 21, 1953, a total of 8,221 casualties, including 1,293 known dead. No statistics are available for the last 3 days of the battle, as units were completely wiped out with their battalion records. However, 165 men of the 1st Colonial Parachute Battalion had been parachuted in on May 5th and 6th, which brought the cumulative total of the Dien Bien Phu garrison to 16,544 men, not counting the 1,916 Thai and Frenchmen of the Lai Chau force who had attempted in November 1953 to march from that city to Dien Bien Phu, or the 2,440 PIMs who had been airlifted in. In view of the violence of the last battles, it is commonly agreed among the French commanders that there were in all likelihood at least another 600 to 800 dead and at least as many wounded. The high proportion of dead during the final phase was due to the fact that most of these casualties were from the heavy artillery bombardment rather than from small arms fire. Total French casualties can be conservatively estimated at close to 9,000, of whom 885, including 27 unwounded medical personnel, were handed over to the French under the battlefield truce of May 1954. This, aside from a handful of escapees, of whom more will be said later, left almost 7,000 troops as prisoners on May 8th. Many of them were far more seriously wounded than those who were finally selected for transfer to the French, but they already had left the battlefield in compact groups of 50 on the 500-mile-long trek to the prison camps north of the Red River or southeastward to the camp complex in Than Hoa province. For the exhausted and mostly wounded survivors of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, this became a death march. This writer has elsewhere covered in detail life in Viet Minh prison camps, and will therefore deal here only with events pertaining to the fate of the prisoners taken at Dien Bien Phu. Two facts stand out about the prisoners from Dien Bien Phu. First of all, their sheer numbers and the necessity of transporting them far away from areas where they could be liberated by the French posed an incredibly difficult problem to the primitive logistical system of the Vietnam People's Army. Second, other French prisoners had usually fallen into communist hands after only a few days of fighting, and, save for the seriously wounded, were not in a state of general physical breakdown. 30 to 60 days of march at a rate of 20 kilometers a day, while carrying rice rations for the column and the numerous litter cases, simply proved too much for most of the men. The food rations allocated to them by their captors did the rest. 14 ounces of rice a day and 10 peanuts every 10th day. Unboiled water and, on a few occasions, light tea constituted the sole drink available. In many cases, the arid countryside near Road 41 limited the availability of water. Dehydration due to continuous dysentery and abnormal perspiration soon transformed the POWs into walking skeletons, reminiscent of German concentration camp photographs. Before the march began, the prisoners still had to undergo a final humiliation. They acted as bit players and manipulated stage props in the reenactment of their own defeat. While some film footage had actually been shot by the Viet Minh during the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, certain major attacks, such as the conquest of Helion II, for example, had taken place either at night or in the absence of qualified Vietnamese combat cameramen. The presence on the scene of the Russian cameraman Carmen now helped to remedy this. On May 14th, all the walking prisoners were herded together in carefully segregated units and paraded past the whirring cameras like the defeated barbarians of 2,000 years ago being paraded through Rome by Caesar. No one was spared this humiliation, from General de Castri to the last Vietnamese auxiliary. But when it came to playing the role of surrendering paratroopers, the paratroopers themselves took their cue from Bijard. When his captors approached him with the demand that he play his own role by walking out of his command bunker with raised hands, Lieutenant Colonel Bijard had looked his captors in the eye and had said quietly, "I'd rather croak." Thus, the Viet Minh picked largely the now leaderless North Africans to replay part of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, dressed in the camouflage battle dress of the French paratroopers. Exactly 10 years later, on May 8, 1964, Colonel Bijard, before a fascinated nationwide television audience in France, commented on the communist-made film on the Battle of Dien Bien Phu and picked out the obvious errors that had been incorporated in its making. There was a scene showing a tank-supported infantry attack punctuated by what appeared to be heavy artillery fire, but the somewhat unsophisticated movie makers had forgotten to eliminate from their film the white-painted medical plane that had brought Dr. Huard to Dien Bien Phu after the battle was over, and whose presence in the picture clearly dated it. Likewise, another scene which purported to show the conquest of Beatrice, which had been held entirely by foreign legionnaires of European extraction, shows the battlefield littered with brown-skinned North Africans. In another sequence, two French tanks could be seen rolling into combat directly behind each other with only inches to spare. That was due to the fact that the Viet Minh, with the help of some of the captured tank crews, had been able to put back into operation only one tank engine. The other tank was simply being towed by its brother. It was said, when the film was projected in France in 1964, that some French officers had deliberately volunteered to become technical advisors to the camera crews of their captors precisely in order to introduce into the film technical mistakes that would brand it as an obvious falsification. If such was their intention, they succeeded, although no one but a very sophisticated audience is likely to spot the errors. To this day, the Dien Bien Phu film is being shown to all the recruits in the Algerian People's Army, and probably to every soldier of the North Vietnamese Army, as an encouraging example of what even primitive guerrillas can do to a modern Western force, provided they are willing to fight and to make sacrifices. For a short while, various groups of French specialists were culled out from the hordes of prisoners in order to keep some of the essential facilities of Dien Bien Phu in working order, such as the water purifiers and the power plants, while some of the others were used to salvage some of the war booty found on the battlefield or to remove some of the minefields. The latter work was never completed. 10 years later, here and there mines would still explode and kill a stray buffalo or maim an unwary farmer's child. A few men were singled out as potential war criminals. The intelligence officers, officers who had worked in the tribal areas, such as Colonel Trancar, and the Air Force officers. The Viet Minh, totally deprived of airplanes, had a particularly deep-seated hatred for the airmen and for the casualties which they invariably caused to the civilian population. When they identified among the prisoners the commander of the air-base detachment, Captain Charnot, they marched him to a grave mound near Ban Co Mai, 3 kilometers south of the main position, where they had buried the civilian victims of a badly aimed French air raid. One by one, Captain Charnot had to unbury the mangled bodies in the blazing sun, look at them, and rebury them. Then he was marched off to the camps. A few days later, as he stumbled numbly along the road, a jeep came to a screeching halt next to him. A Viet Minh officer stepped out of it, looked him over, and said in flawless French, using the bow form, "Don't you remember me? And we attended the lycée together in Montpellier." Charnot now recognized the face under the strange flat helmet, but he could not recall the name of his Vietnamese classmate, who had grown up into an enemy officer. "Come on," said the Viet Minh officer. "I'll take you along. You don't have to walk." The officer exchanged a few words with Charnot's guards, and Charnot changed hands without further formality. He rode to the prison camp in the comparative luxury of a jeep. Even De Castries and his staff rode in trucks, without ever finding out the name of his benefactor. But for most of the other prisoners, the march to the camps was a nightmare, with its scenes of human frailty and incredible fortitude. Major de Mecanem, who had been captured early in the battle on Gabriel, recalled later how the Viet Minh, even in the temporary POW camps prior to the end of the battle, had played off one group of prisoners against the other, and with some success. He particularly remembered in his camp a group of foreign legionnaires of German extraction who had decided, correctly enough, that this was not their war anyway, and that what now counted most was to stay alive until the conclusion of the ceasefire. They informed the camp commander that they had turned progressive and were immediately given a preferred status within the camp, along with improved food rations. Every morning, part of the ceremonial consisted in a lecture by the camp's political commissar on the previous day's victories in the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, and it became the role of the progressives to provide a suitable cheering section for the announcement of such victories. They cheered or gustily sang the Internationale for the defeats of the 3rd BT on Anne-Marie and of the Algerians on the Dominiques. They also had no objections to applauding the destruction of Moroccans and Vietnamese paratroopers on Elian 1. But then came the bitter battles of mid-April for the northern Nugets. One morning, the Viet Minh camp commander read the rousing news that the Foreign Legion infantrymen and paratroopers who had held the northern Nugets had been overwhelmed, and that part of the vital airstrip was now in the hands of the People's Army. There was a dead silence among the assembled prisoners, and, in contrast to established habit, the cheering section of the Progressives also had remained silent. In an annoyed voice, the camp commander turned to them and said, "Come on, sing! What are you waiting for?" The foreign legionnaires looked at each other in silence and then began to sing. There was an instant gasp of shock among the assembled French prisoners, until they recognized the German song, "Ich hat einen Kameraden, einen besseren Dienst du nicht." The turncoat legionnaires were singing the beautiful song with which Germans have honored their war dead since the Napoleonic Wars of 1809. It was one thing to cheer at the demise of the other strange units fighting in the valley. It was another to betray the Foreign Legion. The Progressives were stripped of their special privileges and returned to the rice and water diet of the other prisoners. The officers of the headquarters of Dien Bien Phu were being transported eastward by truck with their hands tied behind their backs and their bodies packed so tightly that the smallest bump of the deeply rutted jungle road threw them helplessly against each other, hour after hour. In their midst were also the war reporters Pierre Schoendorfer, Daniel Camus, and Jean Perrault. Unable to move, they had seen kilometer after kilometer of jungle forest go by, and they knew that with every minute, with every kilometer, they were going farther away from any chance of escaping. Perrault, who had already served a long stretch in a Nazi concentration camp for his activities in the French resistance, was particularly despondent. He said to Schoendorfer, "I've just got to get out of this. I can't do it twice. This time I'm sure I wouldn't come out of it alive." Standing back to back, they searched each other's pockets for an object which could help them to escape. Finally, Perrault found that Schoendorfer still had his Swiss pocket knife in his pocket. At the price of agonizing contortions, he succeeded in reaching it and opening its saw blade. Once this was done, it was not difficult to cut each other's bonds, but the problem arose as to the choice of the proper jumping-off point. Since they were not in the last truck of the convoy, the driver and guards of the following truck would surely see them. Therefore, they would have to wait for a particularly sharp turn, which would force the following truck to slow down enough to be behind the other side of the turn while they were jumping from their own truck. The occasion finally presented itself at the steep crossing of the Black River at Pacoa, almost midway between Dien Bien Phu and Hanoi. As they had calculated, the steep turn forced the truck behind them to an almost complete halt, and with the other prisoners blocking the view from the cab of their own truck, Perrault and Schoendorfer jumped off and headed for the forest at the roadside. They found an almost solid wall of fully grown bamboo. For incredibly long seconds they frantically clawed at it, trying to find an opening wide enough to let their bodies through. Perrault finally succeeded just as the truck was coming around the bend, but Schoendorfer, who had slipped in a puddle of water, was immediately seen by the Viet Minh guards. Shots rang out in all directions as the guards furiously tried to catch up with Perrault, while others clubbed the prone Schoendorfer into unconsciousness and loaded him again on his truck. All his photos of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, which he had hoarded, were taken from him. Perrault was never seen again, although some rumors have it that he was later murdered in the forest by a greedy tribesman, or even that he was later on seen in communist-held Hanoi in the company of a Thai tribal princess who had been caught in the siege ring at Dien Bien Phu. But all this is hearsay. As far as the French army is concerned, Sergeant Jean Perrault of the French Press Information Service in Indochina and attached to the 71st Headquarters Company at Dien Bien Phu disappeared forever somewhere along Road 41 in May 1954. As he had wanted it, he did not have to go through the humiliation of a prison camp twice in his young life. Along other points of this incredible cavalry, small groups of men were fighting off death as best they could. The foreign legionnaires, with their fair skins, were least equipped to withstand the murderous climate, and their highly individualistic attitude led them to let each man fend for himself, although, of course, in many cases, they helped men of their own units or their own nationality. The mainland Frenchmen were hardly better equipped for such a march, but displayed a psychological quality for which they already had been known in Nazi prison camps during World War II, a great amount of group cohesion and of devotion to their wounded and sick comrades. This was particularly true in the case of the paratroop units, who would grimly carry their wounded or sick comrades as long as they were physically able to, often carrying even their dead until the next rest stop, so as to be able to bury them with some sort of decency. There are hundreds of well-documented cases on file with the office of the French Army Surgeon General, attesting to what went on during the trek. One Foreign Legion Chief Warrant Officer cut off his own gangrenous arm with a knife, without anesthesia, and survived the march thanks to his comrades. A paratrooper, blinded by shell fragments, was half-dragged and half-carried for 45 days through the jungle. 4 men died because of the gangrene caused by telephone wire tightly wrapped around their bound arms. An Algerian rifleman, operated on for mortar fragments in the chest and liver on March 15th and captured on May 7th, marched for 45 days to a prison camp, holding together his wound with his unrolled turban. These were the lucky ones, who had friends to care for them. The doctor of the 1st Foreign Legion Parachute Battalion, Lieutenant Jean-Louis Rondy, was later to recall the pathetic sight of a soldier whose legs had been amputated to the thighs, and who, abandoned by everyone, was dragging himself on his hands and the stumps of his legs to the enemy transit camp at Tuanjiao. The result of this sort of treatment of the prisoners was self-evident. Not a single POW with severe injuries of the abdomen, chest, or skull survived captivity. In June and July 1954, 11% of the inmates of Camp 128 died of the ordeal of the march from Dien Bien Phu. Finally, after the war ended on July 20th, the Viet Minh began to repatriate the prisoners. Of the total of 36,979 POWs captured by the Viet Minh since 1946, a total of 10,754, or 28.5%, were repatriated.